All right, good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. This morning, we have a number of bills that are set for a public hearing and a possible work session, as well as a number of work sessions. Based on hydraulics in the building, not everything is back to us that we need to actually move some of the work session bills. The one that I know at this point that we need to put a hold on until Monday, and I'm carrying it over at this point until this next coming Monday, which is our next day to meet, is House Bill 3093A. So 3093A will be carried over till our next day, which my understanding will be Monday of next week, which is June 1st.
Amazing.
Here we go. All right, so if you're here on that, please bear with us. We think the logistics are almost there. Waiting for the hydraulics from the house side and his old hydraulic lines. You know, it takes a while for it to get back and forth.
You got to have the right type of hydraulic fluid, too.
Exactly. Yeah, they need to go to the spring-summer blend and grade. All right. So then, let's see. I think with that... Okay, it looks like we also need to carry over House Bill 2357A. At this point, and so that one we're going to carry over. We don't have the paperwork now. I will say this: if the paperwork rushes in here, we may try to get council back to do that one. But at this point, we're carrying it over to June 1st, next Monday. All right. With that, then, do we want to just shoot that, go at the top, or cause we have some members that are going to be coming in? But my understanding, they're not going to be here until close to 9. So we're going to start back at the top of the public hearing agenda. We'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3015. Laura?
Yes, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. House Bill 3015 is sponsored by Representative Benz. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. It passed the House Committee on Rules unanimously and nearly passed the House floor unanimously with just two legislators excused. We have no amendments before us tonight other. So under current Oregon law, parties possess certain options for changing their names after getting married or entering a registered domestic partnership. House Bill 3015 provides additional options to change one's name after marriage or after entering a registered domestic partnership. Specifically, it allows parties the option of taking one last name or a combination of last names of either or both parties. This bill is ready to move.
Sal, I apologize. Senator Cruz pointed out that you were actually here. We were looking for members earlier, and we did not have notice that you're here. It looks like you're here on 3498. Is that correct? And that's the only one you're here on. So we could suspend what we just started and do that. If you need to get back to what other tasks and duties you have, and I'll take your testimony, then I'll take the others later. Or if you can hang in there for what I expect will be about a 4-minute presentation. If they're listening, we will have you on deck in 5 minutes. That work? All right. So Brian Van Bergen. Brian, you're tasked. 4 minutes, please, or less.
I think it would take 3 because we need a minute to actually move the bill. So.
Thank you for being here. Please put your name on the record and let us hear your perspective.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, and thank you, Representative Sal. Thank you. Chair Pozanski, Vice Chair Cruz, Senators Gelser, Burdick, and Thatcher, good morning. Thank you for letting me join you this morning, and I'll try to keep this at 3.3 minutes. My name is Brian Van Bergen. I am the current Yamhill County Clerk, here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks, in strong support of House Bill 3015. As was just mentioned, House Bill 3015 adds options for folks as they get married or enter into a domestic partnership. This body in the 2013 legislative cycle passed SB 406. This just adds some minor clarifications to that, as there were some disagreements as to what that meant. House Bill 3015 simplifies what the couples can take as their new names after marriage, including their middle names and their last names. In many cultures, children are given a surname from their father and a surname from their mother. giving them two last names or surnames. Under many circumstances, here in the States, those folks tend to use just one of their names. They use those when they go to school. They use those when they try to get their driver's license. All their community members recognize them by a single last name, even though legally they have two last names on their birth certificate. Currently, the issue really is a differing opinion from Oregon Department of Justice and many county councils as to what Senate Bill 406 meant. And that is causing a great deal of confusion and angst. What many of these folks really want is to take a single last name after marriage, and that is one of the things that some county councils and DOJ don't agree with. House Bill 3015 gives them that opportunity. Those that were not given the opportunity have to go and petition to get their name changed, which costs over $100.
So basically what we're looking at is clarifying the previous legislation that was passed and ensuring that those at the time of marriage can actually do this without going through the official name change.
Chair Przanski, that is exactly correct. This really adds a couple of words to the statute that gives them the affirmative right to come out of our office with one name, one last name, or many. Whatever they came in the door with, they get to leave in a combination of, whether that's one or multiple.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? All right. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on House Bill 3015? Didn't see anyone? That's closed. Now we're going to do a work session on House Bill 3015. Senator Cruz.
We've got to bang into work
session. We'll do it that way.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair, I move House Bill 3015 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3015 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Gelser, will you be the carrier?
I would love to.
All right. And we'll close the work session on that. We're now going to drop down to House Bill 3498A.
Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. House Bill 3498A is sponsored by Representative Esquivel. We have no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on this bill. It unanimously passed the House Judiciary, and it passed the House floor with a vote of 58-1 with one excused. We have no amendments before us today. So currently, any person in Oregon who acts as an outfitter or guide must first and annually register with the State Marine Board. Registration requires an affidavit from applicants stating that they have not been convicted of certain crimes consisting mostly of permitting or wildlife violations in the previous 24 months. The board currently has authority to take action, including suspension, revocation, or denial against outfitters and guides who have committed certain violations. House Bill 3498A additionally requires applicants to state by affidavit that they have not been convicted in the previous 24 months of other certain crimes. The bill expands the Legislative Assembly list of violations directly related to fitness required for registration. It authorizes the board in its discretion to reprimand, suspend for up to 24 months, revoke, or deny registration for certain criminal offenses. It additionally directs the board to revoke registration if an outfitter and guide is convicted of a crime prohibiting the possession of a firearm or a crime requiring them to register as a sex offender. The bill authorizes the board to take actions as needed before the operative date. It applies to applications for initial or renewed registration received by the board on or after the effective date, and it applies to convictions of acts committed on or after the effective date. There is an emergency clause to this bill, and it is ready to move.
All right, thank you. Representative Esquivel, and why don't you go ahead, and if Joe can join you since he's sitting next to you, I think that would be nice. And I apologize again, Sal, for not seeing you.
Yeah.
And we'll bring Randy up as well.
He's my brain.
Lifeline?
My brain.
That's quite all right. I just didn't. Sir? I was going to bring him up afterwards since he was neutral.
I only know fish.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. You have in front of you House Bill 3498, which has been pretty much outlined at a 30,000-foot level. There's some other things that I'd like to bring out. First of all, this is a permissive bill. It's not a mandatory bill. It doesn't mandate that the board do this or do that. It does give them the ability, which they do not have today, to revoke or deny a license. What this does is it brings in the crime involving delivery, manufacture, or possession of a controlled substance other than marijuana to the things to be looked at. Also, assault in any degree, criminal homicide, or kidnapping in any degree. They can also react on that. A crime resulting from which prohibits a person from possessing a firearm, I think, is very important. But the one that's the most important to me is the registration of a sex offender. Right now, they have no ability to deny a license if you have a sex offender. And what I do is I look at it like, okay, you take your family down the river with a guide, and you find out after a day or so with your family that you have a registered sex offender. So we have to be very, very careful here, I think. So, but it does give them the discretion to call yay or nay on it. So anyway, I'll let the experts now talk to you more about the guide service, because I'm not a guide.
Senator Perzanski, members of the committee, I'm a retired guide. I got it figured out very early that I needed to go to the ocean rather than stay in the river. Kind of like an anadromous fish, I guess.
And how many years have you been out there?
A long time, 30, I think.
No, I didn't know what the cycle was, you know, for...
Oh, in my cycle, it's a long time, and I haven't developed the right gills yet to survive in fresh water. I'm the...
Joe, I need you to put your name on the
record. My name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport, Oregon. I'm here today representing the... I'm the public member on the Guides Advisory Board to the Marine Board. So the Marine Board is actually the one that makes decisions about whether guides are registered or not and takes this information. The Guides Advisory Committee never sees it, but we advise the Marine Board on issues. The issue came up at our February meeting that the Marine Board did not have discretion to deal with certain kinds of crimes. They could only deal with game law violations, whereas there were other serious crimes that also might preclude a guide from being registered. So the Marine Board, the Guides Advisory Committee asked me to come and bring this this forward to the legislature. The first person that I found with a priority bill was Representative Escobar. He very kindly agreed to move this bill through the House. And again, it's permissive. It gives us more tools to upgrade the folks that work in the guides industry and make our customers more comfortable that we're experienced, that we're skilled, and we have the right background. So Randy is here. Randy Henry from the Marine Board is here. For a long time, he's been our advisor of the Guides Advisory Committee. And the Marine Board is neutral on this bill because it wasn't in the governor's budget. So if you have any questions, yeah, I'm sure Randy would be happy to explain the technicalities to you. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Randy, is there any other comments besides us being here to answer questions that you'd like to put on the record?
I think it's been covered, Senator Brzezinski.
All right, thank you. All right, questions for anyone on the panel?
Yeah.
Senator Thatcher.
Would there be any way to appeal a decision? Like sometimes people get an assault charge and it might, if you looked at it, might look like a pretty minor thing and maybe really long ago. I'm just wondering if there's any way for a person to appeal it.
Yes, Senator Prudensky, Senator Thatcher. We have an administrative hearing process. Any revocation or administrative action that we take against a guide, they are given the option to go through an administrative hearings process. We do several of those a year. We have negotiated some of those for either a conditional registration or additional instruction to the guide to understand, you know, what happened and what we'd like to see that guide operate differently in the future. And we, you know, will abide by the administrative law judge. So each person has that opportunity. As an example, we've had an individual who committed some significant game violations. Upon that process, we discovered that there probably were some simple oversights to that. and we worked with the individual and settled that outside the administrative hearing process with some conditions that they understand the importance of following the game laws. In another situation, we had an individual who very pervasively had violated a number of game laws over the years, and there was just a strong concern on our part that a simple apology was not adequate, so we moved to revoke. It was upheld by the administrative law judge, and that stood.
Thank you.
Randy, just to put on the record, you've given us context of where you have a guy that's already been licensed as revocations. In answer to Senator Thatcher's question, I would assume that if you had a person who was applying and they were denied on the front end, they would also have that appeal right?
Yes, they would, Senator Prezinski.
Any other questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 3498A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 3498A. Open a work session on House Bill 3498A.
Chair, I move House Bill 3498A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3498A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Cruz, will you be the carrier?
Sure.
Senator Cruz will be the carrier. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3498A. And I'm looking at the clock as to what we have in the way of time. Some restraints here. Let me get to one that we can do. All right, we need to probably let Reardon know that he can come over. We got 2 minutes until we do 3399. Let me just ask if there's anyone here on House Bill 3236A. We have no one registered at this point. All right, I think we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3452A.
Yes, Chair Prezinski, members of the committee. House Bill 3452 is sponsored by Representative Widener along with Representatives Johnson, McLean, Nierman, Smith, Stark, and Wisnett. And so this is the one we've got some folks coming in later to talk about. So we have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. It unanimously passed the House Judiciary, and it passed the House floor with 54 yeas and 6 excused. We do have one proposed amendment before us today that we'll hear more about, and that just clarifies the term educational provider. Okay. The inclusion of indemnification clauses within contracts has become increasingly popular in Oregon. In some instances, the breadth of such indemnification clauses has broadened greatly. Often the individuals signing the contracts do not understand exactly what they are signing, nor do they understand the resulting shift in liability. This is especially problematic when such contract clauses are used to protect property or facilities used by educational providers or by nonprofit organizations providing services to youth. House Bill 3452A prohibits indemnification by contract of the owner of a property or facility used by an educational provider or by a nonprofit organization providing services to youth for damages not caused by an individual participant. House Bill 3452A voids contract provisions that fail to comply. The bill applies only to contracts entered into on or after the effective date. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
All right. Now that we've got the summary, I've realized we have two representatives that are actually scheduled to come over later. So what I'm going to do is just go ahead and recess the what will be the public hearing for 3452A. And I know we're at that point where we can start on the 3399A, but I think seeing we've got Eric here, why don't we go ahead and jump to a work session? And we're going to do the work session on House Bill 3347A.
Chair Prezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 3347A comes to this committee from Representative Hoyle. It has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact. We had a public hearing on May 20th. The bill amends the statutory definition of person with mental illness for purposes of our civil commitment statutes. Currently, a person with mental illness is defined as a person who, because of a mental disorder, is unable to provide for their basic personal needs and is not receive such care as necessary for their health and safety. On top of that statute, there are constitutional requirements before someone can be civilly committed, and the Oregon Court of Appeals has defined those requirements in State v. Jane. the court noted that the statute does not express a standard by which the imminence of the threat to life is to be measured. A speculative threat is not itself sufficient. In State v. DP, the court noted that the state need not postpone action until the individual is on the brink of death. The goal of the commitment statute is safe survival, not merely the avoidance of immediate death. And finally, in State v. Corey Aaron, the court noted that there must be a likelihood that the person probably would not survive in the near future because the person is unable to provide for their basic personal needs. And so what this bill does is incorporate the language from that case law and puts it into the statute.
Thank you. So we wanted to put that on the record, so that's part of the legislative intent. It will be carried or covered again on the floor. But let me ask if there's any questions regarding House Bill 3347A after getting that presentation. Senator Gelser.
Mr. Chair, it's not a question. I just really wanted to compliment Representative Hoyle. This was a very difficult issue. It was a very difficult needle to thread. I think it was really significant that Disability Rights Oregon came out as neutral on this bill, which is a very significant position to take on a bill like this. And my hat is off to Representative Hoyle for her excellent work on this.
All right, thank you. Any other comments?
I'm ready for a motion.
You are. All right, so we're ready for a motion.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3347A to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3347A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion.
I support the goals. I just am concerned with potential endless commitment and false commitments, mm-hmm. and I'm just not there yet.
I got it. Other questions or comments? All right. Objections? Register, I assume, Senator Thatcher at this point. Any other objections? Motion carries. Due to the nature of what this is on the technical side, the chair is going to go ahead and carry this on House Bill 3347A. And we'll close the work session on that. So we're now at the point where I think we can go ahead and get started. Excellent. So why don't we do that? Let's see. All right.
We haven't started yet.
We're going to, all right, just to make it, we close the work session on House Bill 3347A. We're now going to go ahead and open up a public hearing, since Rep. Reardon's here, on House Bill 3524A.
Mr. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3524A is sponsored by Representatives Reardon and Parrish. We have no revenue impact, and we do have a fiscal statement issued on this bill. It passed the House Committee on Human Services and Housing 6-3, and it passed the House with a vote of 39-19 with two excused. We do have a proposed -A4 amendment before us today that expands the application to include Indian tribes as defined by statute, and it adds an exemption for the Department of State Lands. Oregon law requires the Department of State Lands, Oregon Department of Transportation, and the Department of Administrative Services to sell real property in surplus. House Bill 3524A requires state agencies selling certain lands to give the first right of refusal to acquire, purchase, exchange, or lease the property to nonprofit organizations for the development of affordable housing. The property must be within an urban growth boundary, an urban reserve, a rural community, or an urban unincorporated community, not being used for public purpose and not needed for public use within 5 years. This bill is ready to move.
All right, thank you. Representative Reardon.
Good morning,
morning,
Chair and committee. My name is Jeff Reardon, State Representative for District 48, and I think you just heard most of my comments, but nice job there. So let me give you just a little bit of background. 2013, I had a housing bill that did not pass, and so I was given the opportunity to have a housing workforce or work group, I should say. And so we did that. We met probably a dozen times, and I had about 42 different concepts that came up. And basically, they kind of boiled down around two things: land and money. I don't have any sources of money. The governor is working on that. This is the about the sole bill that came out of the work group, and it is just to try to make better use or include nonprofits and tribes in the opportunity to purchase land that needs to be disposed of. So ODOT, other agencies turn over a lot of land, And so let me go ahead and read through the remarks. It may sound familiar. This bill makes minor changes to existing statute that deals with the disposition of state lands. A conversation began as part of the housing work group I led last year, and a final concept is something that came out of discussions with ODOT and other agencies on how best to deal with unneeded state lands and facilities. In coming up with this new proposal, I worked with housing advocates, agency reps, and council to find a workable solution. This measure builds upon existing law, which prescribes a process for agencies to use when disposing of land they no longer need. Under this bill, agencies who hold property that is in a proper spot, such as inside an urban growth boundary, an urban reserve, or an unincorporated rural community, and is land for which the agency has no plans for use in the next 5 years, then that must be listed for sale under this their existing process. The property doesn't have to actually sell under this measure, but the agency does need to make the effort to list it for sale and alert the relevant stakeholders. This measure also changes the order in which stakeholders receive notice of property. Under current law, political subdivisions, i.e. local governments, get first bite at the apple. Under this measure, local governments, housing nonprofits, and tribal governments will receive notification at the same time. ODOT and DSL are exempted from Section 3 of the bill because they are constitutional limits on how each agency disposes of property, so their process is very similar but enough different that they are excluded. Nonetheless, we think this is a good step forward in addressing the availability of buildable land in urban areas.
Yes. All right, thank you. Any questions for the representative? Jeff, thank you very much. I think
right,
that's going to
thank
take
you for hearing us.
You bet.
Appreciate
so let me ask one question. There was a dash three, and is that still? I've got a dash three that came in from Reardon's office on Tuesday.
Dash three.
Yeah, it's a. I mean, this is 3524, right?
Yeah. I think I'd like to call on.
Senator Przanski, members of the committee, the Dash 3 amendment amended the bill as introduced. The Dash 4 amends the engrossed version.
Okay. Oh, got it. That's right. Okay. Dash 3 came in because it amended the original bill, and we had to get the Dash 4s to do. And I need your name.
Janet Bird, Neighborhood Partnerships.
Thank you, Janet. All right, that takes care of that. So what we need to do is move the dash fours. All right, just want to make sure we're crossing the T's, not in the I's. All right, go ahead. Closing the public hearing, now opening the work session.
Okay, now we're
how's that?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash A4 amendment in House Bill 3524A.
All right, Senator Cruz moves the dash four amendments into House Bill 3524A. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3524A as amended by the Dash A4 amendment to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3524A as amended by the A4 amendments to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, and I see him lingering by the door. Yeah. Maybe I would like to talk to you later.
Oh.
We're having a vote, but I do have some questions for you that perhaps we can, you know, take offline. That's fine.
Okay.
But I have some questions before I commit a yes.
Okay.
All right.
Do you want to do that now or do you want to do offline?
I can ask the questions. I just want to have a conversation with them.
Okay. All right. So. Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Thank you.
All right. And so we're now at a point where any other comments or questions? All right. Any objections? I'm assuming Senator Thatcher's reserving your position until you have a chance
I'll
to talk.
I'll be a no for now.
No? Okay. All right. Any other not seeing any motion carries? And I want to give this also to Senator Chair will carry this since Gelser's out of the room, and Gelser will be down as an excused. All right, so I'm waiting for another couple of representatives to come in. I know we can start the 3399, but I think we're going to go ahead and take care of one other work session that we have the paperwork now on. Is that correct? All right, so we're going to do House Bill 3164A and go ahead and take care of that.
Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. House Bill 3164A is sponsored by Representatives Benz and Hoyle at the request of the Pacific Hardware and Implement Association. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. It passed the House Business and Labor Committee as well as the House floor with all yeas and a couple of excused votes. We previously heard this bill for public hearing here on May 21st. Before us today, we do have a proposed -A11 amendment. We had some discussion at the public hearing about some additional changes, and that has come in through this amendment to clarify the definition of change in competitive circumstances. Oregon's equipment dealer protection laws address provisions governing agreements between retailers and suppliers of farm implements. House Bill 3164A clarifies the conditions under which a supplier may claim good cause to terminate, cancel, or fail to renew or make a change in competitive circumstances. The bill also modifies the definition of change in competitive circumstances. Additionally, it increases the supplier notice requirement from 12 months to 18 months in advance of their intent to terminate, cancel, or not renew an agreement, or to cause a change in the competitive circumstances for the retailer when there is good cause based on the retailer's failure to make marketing criteria. We do have the paperwork. This is ready to move.
-A11 amendment into House Bill 3164.
Senator Cruz moves the -A11 amendments into House Bill 3164A. Any discussion?
Are these the amendments that the two parties agreed on?
These are the ones we have. I was going to get ready to say Senator Beyer, Farmer Senator Beyer, but the one of the participants in that has a thumbs up. This is what we wanted, and so I think we're fine.
The other one's in the back, and he can give a thumbs up.
And there's
right.
Also
we're good.
Heads are nodding.
Why aren't they sitting next to each other in a kumbaya moment? Yeah. All right. Any other questions? Any objection to the motion? Not seeing any. So ordered. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3164A as amended by the -A11 amendment to the floor to be passed recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3164A as amended by the 11As to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, will you be the carrier?
I would love to.
And we'll close the work session on that bill. So I think at this point we're getting close to where we maybe can time our testimony on House Bill 3399 and be able to have, I know we have a representative coming over sometime this after this starts. So let's go ahead and open up the, this is a public hearing that's continued from what we had previously. I believe it's been over, a little bit over a week. So open up a public hearing on House Bill 3399A. Chana?
Onsky, members of the committee, you heard House Bill 3399 on May 20th of last week. It requires justices of the peace and municipal court judges to either hold a Juris Doctorate degree or to complete a course on courts of special jurisdiction offered by the National Judicial College. Additionally, the measure requires that these courts make and keep audio recordings or transcripts of misdemeanor and felony criminal proceedings for a period of 12 months. You have a variety of amendments before you. The proposed A9 amendments remove an allowance for completion of an alternative education program as determined by the district court judge in that court's district. The proposed A10 amendments clarify what degree is required. There was a little bit of question about the language there, so that's just kind of a technical amendment. And then we posted early this morning the A11 amendments from Senator Thatcher, which allow the parties to arrange a recording of the proceedings, including by stenographic means, and put the cost of the recording on the party arranging the recording unless they otherwise agree. We do not have the fiscals on these amendments, so it is not ready to move today.
All right, so we're going to take testimony today. Clarification on the -11s. Is that a replacement slash?
It is, Senator Przanski, it is in addition to the remainder of the bill. It does not delete any provisions of the measure.
All righty. Okay, with that said, thank you very much for the clarification. Carl, why don't you and Jad come on up? And while they're coming up, I just want to see, is there anyone else that's here today that wants to give testimony on 3399A? Gentlemen, who would like to start?
Good morning, Chairman Brzezinski, members of the committee. I'm Jad Lemhouse, Linn County Justice of the Peace. I'm here to offer some testimony with respect to House Bill 3399A. If you've reviewed the materials that I've written, materials that I've submitted to the committee, you understand that I've had some continuing problems with some of the provisions of this bill, in that there seems to be an asymmetry or incongruence between one of the complaints having to do with the recording piece and the response in this legislation. There have been testimony submitted to both the House committee and to this committee that some local court judges will not allow parties to record the proceedings in the particular local court, and that is in fact true. The response, however, is asymmetrical to that complaint. A symmetrical complaint would address that particular complaint and allow the recording of criminal proceedings in local courts. It would not require local courts to record all criminal proceedings or misdemeanor proceedings, just those where one of the parties wishes to make the record. By requiring everybody to record everything, so to speak, with respect to prosecutions for misdemeanor crimes, then we're going to drive significant costs to the local courts. I've submitted a memorandum yesterday afternoon, it should be in your materials, that show that the costs are not insignificant. For Linn County to establish a recording system would run somewhere between $15,000 and $24,000, and that is far outside of anything in my budget for the current fiscal year that's going to begin in July of this year. And in fact, most of the local courts are on an annual budget, and their annual budget is set sometime in usually April or May. And here we are in late May, and we're still talking about this bill. It will take effect if it is in fact enacted, it will take effect probably around the 1st of January of 2016, and no local court will have in their budget an item for a recording system. So if we're going to have a bill such as this to take effect, we really need to start it when it can be budgeted for by the local jurisdictions, and that really is the fiscal year that ends in 2017, not the fiscal year that ends in 2016. So we need to address that particular issue, both the cost to the local governments and the when the bill is going to take effect. One of the problems with an effective date is that criminal proceedings don't just start and stop instantaneously. A criminal proceeding starts when a complaint is filed in a court, then it proceeds for several months, sometimes a year to a year and a half, before we actually get to a resolution. If this bill takes effect while criminal proceedings are pending, does the bill affect those pending criminal proceedings? Or can they continue until the end? Because there are some cities and counties that will not be able to afford the cost of recording systems. So they're no longer going to prosecute crimes in the justice court or the municipal court. They're going to send them all to the circuit court, which, of course, would increase the demand for indigent defense, would increase the requirement for circuit court judges, and increase the cost generally to the state for handling those kinds of cases. So we have these multiple layers of issues, which unfortunately were not introduced until after this session began. These are the kinds of issues, really, that should be addressed by a work group that includes both the parties who are complaining about the problem, the parties who are going to be affected by the problem, and the legislators are going to have to deal with the problem. That was not done in this case, and so we've had this continuing problem of trying to adjust this bill so that it would fit, get some congruence and symmetry between the complaints and the response. and we've not been able to do it so far. It's if you enact this bill in its present form, we're going to have continuing problems that you're going to be addressing in both the 2015 session, or excuse me, the 2016 session and the 2017 session, probably in order to get them straightened out. So what I would strongly suggest that you do is, if we have to have this bill, fix it so that it's going to work. One of the amendments that's been proposed is the Dash 9 amendment that really is a kind of a fail-safe situation. There are two pieces to this bill. One is the qualifications for office, and the other is the recording issue that I've spoken to mostly so far. With respect to the qualification issue, keep in mind that qualifications for office are personal. They're not an obligation of the city or the county that operates the courts. It's the obligation of the person who holds the office to meet the qualification. There are some cities and counties that will not be able to underwrite the costs, even though they would like to meet the qualification requirement. The qualification requirement basically requires a two-week course at the National Judicial College, which just for tuition alone is about $2,100. Add to that the transportation costs, lodging and meals, and you probably got around $5,000 tied up in that two-week course. There are some individuals and some counties and some cities who are simply not going to be able to afford to do that cost. The Dash 9 amendment would eliminate the ability for those cities, counties, and judges to apply to the circuit court judge of the county in which the jurisdiction is located for an alternative to that expensive but useful National Judicial College course. So I would urge you not to adopt the Dash 9 amendments. Leave that provision in the bill for both justices of the peace and municipal court judges, because it's going to be an extremely important alternative for just a few, but some, justice and municipal courts. The Dash 10 amendment is intended simply to clarify a provision that came through in the 3399A that was adopted by the House that refers to a specific type of college degree, a Juris Doctor. Well, I don't have a Juris Doctor. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar in good standing. I have a degree from an accredited law school. But my degree says Doctor of Jurisprudence. There are a number of law schools, probably declining in number pretty significantly, that still offer what's called an LLB, Bachelor of Laws degrees, which is an equivalent degree to a Doctor of Jurisprudence or a Juris Doctor degree. And there are some individuals who have both an LLB, an LLM, which is a Master's of Law degree, and an LLD, a Doctor's of Law degree, and those are advanced degrees beyond just the standard Juris Doctor or Doctor of Jurisprudence degrees. And so what this Dash 10 amendment does is it enables a person who meets the qualification that they have a law degree from an accredited university that's been accredited by the Oregon, by the American Bar Association, to hold that office, because they've had the appropriate legal training. Even though they may not be a member of the Oregon State Bar, nonetheless, they've had the appropriate legal training. I've not seen the Dash 11 amendment, but it sounds like something that probably, I don't know if it's offered in lieu of Sections 1 and 4, or if it's in addition to Sections 1 and 4 of the bill. That's not completely clear to me, but it is in line with what I suggested with respect to the recording piece, and that is, require that when a party asks a local court judge to make a recording, that the court allow that to be done. Most of us do. I, for example, have had several requests for a session to be recorded, and I've allowed it, subject to certain conditions. Number one, it has to be made by a certified court reporter or somebody with appropriate certification to record the proceeding. Number two, if a transcript is made, then a transcript has to be filed with the court. Number three, if a transcript is made at the request of a party, then the transcript, a copy of the transcript, has to be offered at cost to the adverse party. And number four, the party requesting the recording pay for the cost of the recording. That way they get what they want to have. They get the recording. It's a full, true, accurate, and complete copy of the whole record. No pieces are excerpted. The certified court reporter certifies to the court and to the parties that the record that they have made is included in that transcript. We can't just have anybody coming in with a tape recorder or a cell phone or whatever kind of a device that has a capability of making a recording and making a recording and then producing some sort of a transcript from that recording. We don't know what's in that transcript and how accurate it is. If a transcript is made by a certified court reporter or somebody who has the certification to make a recording of a court process proceeding, then we have some assurance that the transcript that subsequently follows from that is a true, a correct, an accurate, and a complete recording of the proceeding. And that's what's required. There's really no substitute for that standard. It's either true, complete, accurate, and full, or it's not. And it's, we need to have somebody who can produce that type of a record. I think I'll probably give my colleague an opportunity to speak now. My throat is getting a little dry. So if you have any particular questions to address to me at this point in time, I'd be happy to answer them.
We'll wait on the questions. Carl, before you start, I have two representatives here. I know they have time sensitive. I just want to make certain they can stay. Carl, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. My name is Carl Myers. I am the presiding judge in the city of Kaiser, also the presiding judge in the city of Jefferson. I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association, the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, which we have a significant opposition to the original bill and to the bill in front of you, 3399A. I will say right up front, first of all, I want to thank the chair for continuing this hearing. It was held a week ago Wednesday, and Wednesday is my day in Kaiser. I had a very full docket with trials and other matters and could not come here to testify, so I appreciate you holding it over to a day when I'm not in court. Let me say off the top that if you pass the -10 and -11 amendments, do not pass the -9 amendments, most of our concerns for this bill will go away. We, quite frankly, with the amendments on the qualifications that came out of the House that allowed the circuit court judge to come up with an alternative plan for education, we were relatively happy with that. We would prefer that the controller of that kind of discretion would be the Chief Justice, who is in charge of all judges in this state. But if it was to a local circuit court judge, where local programs and needs of the community can be considered, we're happy with that. We do not like. Have great concerns about sending people to the National Judicial Conference, although most of our members who are not lawyers have attended. Not all have attended for the full amount because of budget constraints, time constraints, and whatever. Judge Lemhouse mentioned a $5,000 cost for going to that. Excuse me. That includes tuition, room and board, and travel. It does not include wages paid to the judge while they are there. Most counties and cities would end up having to pay the judge for their time at a 10-day or 2-week conference, which could end up being additional thousands of dollars. So that needs to be factored in. My comments, I'll try to keep relatively short because they are covered. All of our comments are covered fairly well in the written testimony, and I would recommend that you read those thoroughly because the matters before you are complicated. Our concern was that this bill, while the intention is good, The details are problematic for not only the courts, but those that use the courts and the local jurisdictions that fund the courts. And we would like to see something, if you're going to go down this road, as Judge Lemhaus said, let's do it studied, considered, and make sure that it's done right so that we don't have problems. I will address just briefly, we have some constitutional concerns about the bill in the first place. First of all, can a legislature mandate the qualifications for a municipal court judge? In that the qualifications for a municipal court judge are included in the charter of the city, and Article 11, Section 2 of the Oregon Constitution says a legislative assembly shall not enact, amend, or repeal any charter or act of incorporation of any municipality, city, or town, which if you impose these qualifications on a municipal court judge, you have essentially amended the charter. I tried to look through to find out if there were any cases that would help us decide whether that applies in this case. I could find none, but it is very clear that that section says that the legislature must stay away, with one exception, should stay away from managing how a city manages itself. And that one exception is adoption of criminal laws that conflict with the criminal laws of the state of Oregon. We also are concerned about this as being a home rule issue. Are the home rule counties and home rule cities who have adopted their own qualifications for a judge, can they be overridden by the legislature? That is a question that, quite frankly, I don't think anybody has the answer to, but I know that there are people researching this and the previous question as we speak. There are several city attorneys and county attorneys who believe that that the home rule provision prevents the legislature from setting those qualifications for local judges. And then lastly, is this an unfunded mandate because of the cost that you're imposing? I would submit to you, quite frankly, if this bill dealt with state courts instead of local courts, this bill would be going to the Ways and Means Committee because of the funding issues, the revenue issues, et cetera. I want to say just a couple more things. We have two bills. This bill was designed, I believe, to help improve the public perceptions of the court, an admirable goal, and certainly one that I and the rest of our members approve of. There are two other bills that have this goal, at least that I know of. The police law enforcement body camera bill and the grand jury recording bill. But both of those bills had significant vetting. All parties were involved, and some standards were applied, adopted, and discussed, supplied, and adopted to make sure that the bill worked. 3399A had none of that vetting, had none of the discussions. For instance, the body camera bill has a portion that talks about, since it is a public record, what access can the public have to that record? 3399A, those tapes or records of the proceedings are public record, and there is nothing in the bill that says who has access to them, when they can be accessed by whomever, and is there a limitation on that access for whatever reason. None of that is in, there are no standards in the bill as to the recording. The grand jury recording bill has a provision that if through inadvertence, the tape doesn't work, or the grand jury proceedings is not recorded or completely recorded, through inadvertence, then no harm, no foul. In this case, 3399A has none of those provisions, so that if a court were recording something, the recording didn't turn out, it had not been turned on, the recording was broken, do you use a tape, do you use electronic media, et cetera, what happens if that does not come about? Is it a retrial? Is it a dismissal of the charges? Is it an automatic appeal to the circuit court? What happens if the record doesn't turn out? There is nothing in the bill that describes that. While the proponents say that the cost to the local governments would be minimal, I strongly disagree. I think there are significant costs, and quite frankly, the costs fall on the counties and cities least able to handle them, the rural counties. Justice courts in the rural counties, the rural municipal courts that don't have an awful lot of money to begin with and are being strapped further. I want to point to the city of Kaiser, and I will say that the city of Kaiser is not impacted by this bill. I do have a doctor of jurisprudence, so if the Dash 10 amendments don't pass, I may be out of a job. But we do not handle criminal matters, misdemeanor or felony matters in the city of Kaiser. Nevertheless, the city of Kaiser, because of the PERS decision and some other factors that are going into our budget proceedings, I'm being asked now if I can afford to lose a halftime clerk that we have to handle the court. I don't want to. We have taken on additional responsibilities and handled truancy matters in the city of Kaiser, and those take an awful lot of time and an awful lot of staff time to handle. If this bill passes and it were to apply to the city of Kaiser, I am sure the city councilors would, first of all, discontinue our truancy violation program, which has been very successful. We've gotten a number of kids back into school when the school district has failed. We would also, if we handled criminal matters, give up on those, quit handling those criminal matters, in large part because those two issues, those two case types, are the types that cost the city money and which we get little or no return. So the city would no longer be able to underwrite those programs, and we'd have to send them off to the circuit court. We just think that this bill needs some time to be thought through. Every time I look at the bill, I find another issue. I was the one that discovered the Juris Doctor issue after it had passed out of the House, decided to look at my diploma to determine whether I was a Juris Doctor or Doctor of Jurisprudence, and University of Oregon School of Law says I've got a Doctor of Jurisprudence and not a Juris Doctor. I checked. Willamette offers doctors of jurisprudence. I'm not sure about Lewis and Clark, but nevertheless, the Dash 10s need to be in there because it inadvertently excludes a significant number of qualified people. The other thing that I would add, quite frankly, if I were to do that, is the Dash 10s include not only graduation from an accredited law school, but a membership in the Oregon State Bar. I cannot imagine that somebody who has a law degree from the East Coast, nothing against the East Coast, but has practiced, let's say, patent law all their lives, comes out to Oregon to retire and decides to take up a judgeship in a justice court or a municipal court. They are not members of the bar because they have retired. While they are accredited graduates from an accredited institution, they may have not ever practiced criminal law or any kind of law in Oregon that would allow them to know or at least have a background in how Oregon criminal law is processed, what the Oregon constitutional rights are, etc. In Kaiser, the charter says I must be a member of the Oregon State Bar. Therefore, my pro tems must also be members of the Oregon State Bar. And on that note, I will just say you need to take a look, also consider the costs of sending the JPs to these various conferences and whatnot, because if a presiding judge is required to be a member of the to have certain qualifications, the pro tems are as well, and those will be additional costs. I just want to say the proponents believe that if this bill passes, we will force the local jurisdictions to abide by the bill. I am convinced, and I have heard comments from a number of judges and other city and county officials, that if this bill passes, they are likely to close their courts. I cannot tell you how many of those are. I know that we are losing courts because of the cost. Jackson County almost lost their JP court. Several courts up and down, city courts up and down the valley have closed and are sending their things off to either a justice court or a circuit court. The added burden of these costs, even if they're as low as the proponents say, and again, we do not accede to that estimation, I think we will still see courts shut down and an extra burden placed on the state courts to handle the matters that are much more expediently and timely handled at the local courts that are now doing them. With that, I'll make myself available for any questions.
All right. I tell you, I have a lot of questions. I also have Representative Smith here who wants to give some testimony on this. I think what I'm going to do is just put you all on notice. I want you all to stand by because I'm going to put this on the record. So, Representative Smith, I assume you need to probably come and go. Yes, please come on up. And then we're going to take a short break after this because I'm going to get the representative's testimony in on the other bill so we can carry the dialogue on down to 3399.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. I had the distinct pleasure of representing Umatilla County and Morrow County and Gillum County and Sherman County and the very best parts of Wasco County. I'm here today to talk about House Bill 3399 and to lend my voice of support for passage of what I believe is a well-thought-out piece of legislation. Colleagues, yesterday you heard from Representative Nathanson on what this measure does, what this bill does. What I want to do is just put a little perspective with how we got to where we are today. Representative Nathanson came and visited with me and shared with me some of her thoughts and concerns as it related to the handling of court proceedings. And I thought there was some logic in what she was sharing, but I was unsure. And so I brought together my judges from Sherman County and from Wheeler County, from Malheur County, and from Harney County. And we sat down and we had a conversation. And when the conversation was complete, there was support for House Bill 3399. There was a belief that the educational requirement was not overly burdensome and that, for the most part, this is already being completed and that for many of our Justice of the Peace who are coming in for a first time, it's a good opportunity for them to really make sure they understand the work that they're going to be involved in. When you look at the National Judicial College and what goes on in the special court jurisdiction, there's many topics that are critical for these folks to understand. And so I don't think it's overly burdensome to ask our new justices of the peace to participate in this. I'd point out we're not breaking entirely new ground here. Texas, Pennsylvania, Montana, Delaware, and Nevada already have some form of educational requirement, and so Oregon would just be joining these other states. Second, the question of recordings has come up. Again, we had an opportunity to visit with some of the folks in Eastern Oregon who are supporting this legislation, and none of them felt as if it was going to be overly financially burdensome. Now, you've heard that courts may close down and proceedings will not occur. What I would share with you is the judge from Wheeler County, Oregon's smallest county, the county with the smallest budget, felt as if they would be more than able to accommodate this this mandate. And so I would have that put on the record. Second, I would just share with you, I think it's good to have transparency. It's good to have transparency in government, in contracts, in the budgeting process, and in the criminal justice system. And I believe this House bill moves us in that direction. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm very pleased to add my support to this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Reverend Smith. Any questions or comments for the representative? Greg, thank you very much.
Have a great day.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and recess out 3399A for the intention of reopening what we started earlier this morning on House Bill 3452A for the purpose of taking testimony from the two representatives that are here on the bill. Representative McLean and Representative Barton, thank you for being here. Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Prezansky and members of the Senate, my name is Mike McClain. I represent House District 55, which is Central and Southern Oregon. I went to Representative Widener and others and asked them to be on this bill, and this came out of a situation which we see occurring more in some of the rural areas where we have, because of either funding issues or access issues, as kids add more activities, specifically equestrian, that's where folks ride around horses, and then lacrosse, which is growing in popularity in rural towns. But so what happens a lot is these kids have clubs, not necessarily sponsored OSAA sports, but they do it in the sense of clubs, and then they compete with other schools. They use private property. Who folks are very generous about letting youth groups or school activities use private property. What's common is a waiver is requested for the parents to sign on behalf of their kids, and I have no problems with that. If my daughter, who does equestrian, falls off her horse and breaks an ankle, then I understand that's our responsibility, and we're not going to sue the landowner. But what has happened is starting to prop up in some of these contracts is an indemnification clause, which is quite different. So in an indemnification, what I was asked to do is to indemnify the landowner against all claims, damages, cost, including attorney's fees that could happen as a result of that event taking place on that private property. Now, I'm prepared to waive all legal action that I could bring on behalf of my daughter. What I'm not prepared to do is become a de facto insurance policy for the landowner for that event. And ultimately, because indemnifications used to be common, people didn't think about them because of the Great Recession in Central Oregon. People actually had to litigate indemnification clauses as they were invoked. And what they are is contingent liabilities. And so if anyone refinances their house, for an example, had I signed it that day so my daughter could have ridden her horse with the equestrian club on a private property, I would have had to disclose to the refi when I lowered my interest rate to 4%, which I was excited about. And but I would have had to disclose that I had a contingent liability, meaning that I have no idea until the statute of limitations runs who would sue who as a result of that day. So indemnification clauses in these types of contracts are very different. I am concerned that not everyone who signs them truly understands that they are creating a contingent liability that may indeed have reporting requirements to federally insured banking institutions. And I think because you have your kid participate in lacrosse or equestrian or something like that, family's personal wealth should not be put at risk. So I, on the one hand, don't want to chill the generosity of private landowners. On the other hand, I don't believe that will happen because waiver clauses are common. And it wasn't until recently we started seeing indemnification clauses appear, which I think really are over-aggressive attorney drafting by people like Brent Burton and myself in our professional capacity. But nevertheless, as a state representative, I think it's bad policy. And I ask that we would protect the families of kids who participate in activities on private property. Waivers are a good thing and reasonable to pass. Indemnification have the consequences, I said, and I think are unreasonable, and I don't think they're bargained for, and I don't think, frankly, people truly understand what they're signing when they do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Prezansky, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent House District 40. And a question of counsel, if I may, before I begin my remarks, have the Dash A3 amendments been prepared yet?
No, I have not received dash A3. No.
So with the permission, Chair Przanski, I'd like to testify in support of House Bill 3452. In fact, I like the bill so much that I actually think, with Representative McLean's permission, that this committee should seriously contemplate expanding it in what will be anticipated A3 amendments, which will broaden it. The bill as drafted just applies to educational contexts. And frankly, the argument is sound. It really should be broadened, I think, to all of them. And I think it would make for a cleaner policy. So echoing some of Representative McLean's remarks, much of what we do in state legislatures, we deal a lot in technical fixes. And in terms of the contentious policy bills, they tend to be on matters that are of great concern to a relatively small group of people. This bill, in many respects, in this issue, is perhaps the opposite of that. This is a relatively minor issue to arguably everyone in the state of Oregon. Every single one of us who enter into form contracts, which we do more often than you might think, for example, your cell phone, every bill that you receive, underneath that, there is a contract. Now, very, very few of those contracts are actually negotiated line by line, item by item. There's give and take. That's when we think of a contract and where indemnification clauses are appropriate. It's those kinds of arm's length negotiations, say in a purchase and sale of an item or a business, in which you are going back and forth and you are in turn indemnifying the other party, but usually in exchange for something, or in order to facilitate the sale of a business or something of that effect. On what we call, lawyers call contracts of adhesion, which really are just form contracts. That's like your cell phone bill. AT&T and I did not actually negotiate our contract. There was no give and take. That's not how contracts of adhesion work. It is frankly inappropriate for indemnification clauses to be enforceable in the vast majority of those situations. I say vast majority. I can't think of any situation in which that I think would be okay. But they should be presumptively unenforceable. Representative McLean brought this issue forward, and his bill, being temperamentally cautious legislative craftsman, just restricted it to educational context, citing the examples he used, for example, his daughter doing equestrian activities through her school. However, and he's absolutely right, I supported the bill on the Judiciary Committee. I don't have any personal investment in the bill. I just heard it in my capacity on the House side. But while talking to Representative McLean on the House floor later, saying, you know, this is a good idea, we should work on expanding it in future sessions. Because this is not just an educational issue. It really is in all form contracts. And so with his permission and with Chair Przanski's permission, we're preparing some dash 3 amendments, which will really broaden this principle, because the principle, I think, applies equally. So having said that, if I can answer any questions, and I appreciate your entertaining a new amendment, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher first.
Thank you. Since you're the master craftsman of this bill, both of you, I guess, there is a concern that's being brought up that I guess it's presumed that the property owner would be better able to absorb the costs than the parents of the equestrian, you know, for the liability. But the issue brought up is that if the property owner is a nonprofit organization, that their ability to absorb these costs from increased liability insurance, I guess, is what they're talking about, would be substantially less, because they wouldn't have necessarily those resources or not, you know, just rolling in money. Would you be amenable, or would you think about an amendment to exclude property owners who are nonprofit organizations? Would you have any response to that?
Well, Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher, from my view, I think the principle is the same no matter who the landowner is. If nonprofits, for an example, I'm on the board and have served with Young Life in Prineville, which is a nonprofit organization, and that nonprofit has summer camps, and kids go to the summer camps. The kids sign waivers, so they can't sue Young Life. The question comes is whether each one of those kids, if you have 500 kids at a camp, one, they all sign waivers, and one sues the camp 499 of them, if they sign an indemnification, that's 499 families whose financial assets are now put up to cover the full cost of any litigation or anything associated with that one individual trying to break the waiver or something totally unforeseen. And so I look at it this way, and why I don't like the amendment that you mentioned is that for those 499 people in that hypothetical, you have them a contingent liability on that family until the statute of limitations would run from that event. And I don't think they understand, many of them, and they don't know to report it. And they could be, if you refinance and you don't put on your financial statement that you have a contingent liability, you could be, I'm not saying you are, you could be misrepresenting information to a bank insured by the FDIC. It's just the cascading problems from it. I understand from a nonprofit standpoint this is, but what if we get sued? Their protection is the waiver. And this has nothing to do with the waiver that they would ask kids to sign. If there's anything beyond the waiver that would be at risk, then I would think that the landowner has more capability to cover that cost through an insurance rider for the event or the camp and could disperse that cost amongst those who attend, as opposed to each individual member having each individual kid's family having signed indemnification. And these indemnification means that every single one who signs it means that their assets have to be pledged ultimately to pay for the cost of a lawsuit that they didn't cause or their kid didn't cause. So in that regard, the principle doesn't change based upon who the owner of the property is. And for all those reasons, and with great empathy towards nonprofits who sponsor events for kids, I would decline and say that I don't think that is an amendment that best serves our state.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, I'd like to echo Representative McLean's remarks. I agree with them entirely, actually. This committee, if I'm not mistaken, had some perhaps painful hearings earlier this session involving waivers. And I think in response to a Supreme Court case called Bagley v. Mount Bachelor. This committee heard that, correct? That has to do, those are issues with waivers. And I think the concerns that you are reflecting in your question have to do in large part with waivers. Indemnification really is analytically quite different. And I think I view this, the waivers do to a large extent limit the liability of, for example, the landowner. Indemnification
insures them, basically.
It creates that contingent liability that then, in turn, triggers perhaps a duty to report contingent liabilities, for example, when you apply for a mortgage or refinance your home. And which of us have ever actually thought to report indemnification, whatever that we might have done, on that? I just fear that many, many people might not have done that, in which case, if they purposely didn't do that, for example, that creates a can of worms, and not to be histrionic, but that's potentially fraud. And if you put a stamp on that, then it's mail fraud. It goes down a slippery slope. And so I kind of view this as a consumer protection issue, really, for everyone in Oregon.
Yeah, let me just – I think we understand that. I mean, for me, the way to look at this is that if you had a child who went to a summer camp and there was another child at that camp that got injured and the parents go to sue them, if you have an indemnification, you're on the hook or potentially on the hook for whatever comes out of that litigation as compared to, okay, I'm going to let my kid go to this camp. I'm signing a waiver. If my kid gets hurt here, I'm waiving these type of causes of action. And so
– perfect. Well said, Mr. Chair.
And, you know, and what our certified smart legal counsel is saying to us, not only does that happen, but you have all these other unintended consequences that could actually cause you to be in a quagmire of other legal difficulties that people just don't realize. It's just like going through what are those agreements, the ones on the cell phones where you are basically agreeing to this, and you're just clicking through, and there's like 30 pages of who knows what that you just did just so you can actually use your phone. and stuff like that. And so those are the type of things that bite you. Other questions?
Oh, no, I think there will be testimony coming up. And I might not have expressed it correctly, the context of what the concerns were. But I think there will be testimony if we have time today.
Yeah, we've got one other person I know that's going to come up and give testimony for at least one more. All right, any other questions for the representatives? All right, so my understanding is that we're going to wait for the A3s. And once the A3s, you two are going to look at them and determine that that's A-OK, and then we'll get the paperwork and we'll move it. And if there's a problem, I just want to make sure we got a time frame, because next week is our, you know, that bewitching day will be coming. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and thank you to counsel for your help with drafting the amendments.
And, Mr. Chair, I saw that 3256 is also up today. Has that been heard yet? And I apologize that I don't know. Are you going to carry it over or hear that today? 3256 is about a covenant not to compete timeline.
Oh, 3236.
Yeah, House Bill 3256, is it?
We don't have it up.
Is it?
We got 3236.
Oh, 3236, my eyes. Is that up today?
That is, and and the reality is I actually called out because I had no one scheduled to give testimony. So, Representative McLean, if you're actually here on House Bill 3236A, and that's the one that deals with limited limits and enforceability on non-compete agreements to 18 months.
Yes, I sponsored the bill. I'd be happy to offer testimony. If you deem it unnecessary, then I, you know, will stop talking.
Well, why don't we do this? I haven't had that on the record yet. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a recess here real quick, because I will put it on the record and you can make your comments. Then y'all two can do your other task in the building. So
thank you.
We're going to take a recess again on House Bill 3452A. We're now going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3236A.
Yes, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3236A is sponsored by Representative McLean and Senator Farioli. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on this bill. The bill passed the House Committee on Business and Labor with a vote of 10-1, and it passed the House with a vote of 45-6 nays, and the rest were excused. We have no amendments before us today. So under current Oregon law, non-competition agreements entered into between an employer and employee is enforceable for up to 2 years. House Bill 3236A reduces the enforceable term of non-competition agreement to 18 months or a reduction of 6 months. This bill is ready to move today.
All right, thank you. Representative McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I sponsor 3236 because at the business summit last fall, it was actually early January, but I was reading, they asked for ideas about how to increase innovation and jobs in Oregon, and as we were preparing to pontificate at great length, I came across an article that talked about innovation sectors in some of the states. There it is, actually. Thank you, Laura. And it talks about how some states have produced innovation sectors, which when you have in our state, a good example would be when you have a Nike, brings in enormous amounts of talent, produces products, jobs, and is a great benefit to the community. And at a certain size, they often will say, hey, this is too small of a sector for us, or we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And so some ideas don't get done. And what they found is that in a few states, people leave companies and start up businesses. And this sort of innovation, which it's the spawning of businesses, which grow and grow and grow and spawn others. And one of the this Harvard analysis went through and said, you know, the one thing we didn't know, but when we went through all this analysis, is we found that the spawning of these businesses correlated to non-compete lengths. And so the irony was, the shorter their non-compete, the more spawning of business. And it makes sense, because in those where they didn't have non-competes, folks would make the evaluation of saying, well, hey, I like this idea. My company's not going to do this, so I'm going to take it and start up my own company and run with this idea because I really think it can work. But when they're locked down by a non-compete, and I understand the rationale of non-competes, then they don't leave, or if a non-compete's short enough, then they make a decision and there's more of a rational analysis. So I just mentioned it to Senator Ferrioli, and he said, great, let's just drop a bill and see what it does. And I think I had recommended 1 year, because at a year, people then, because you can't walk out the next day and start a business. There's some prep time. It would really protect businesses who invest and bring in people and say, hey, I've made investment in you. Don't go out and compete. So they want protection of their investment for a time versus the balance of trying to encourage innovation in more jobs. We are a state where we need people being innovative and creating jobs. So in that regard, I put out the bill. It was amended from 12 months to 18 months and kind of split the baby there. And that's why the bill's here. This is not a silver bullet for Oregon. It's not something that I am, dying on the hill for. This is not my take-home bill, but it was an idea. I think these states who have actually struck that balance, I think that report's right. I actually think Oregon would be served by a shorter non-compete time. And so I leave it to, obviously, your discretion whether you want to move the bill or think about it and we'll try it next time or anything. I think the line should be 12 months. So the committee in the House gave me 18.
Can you give us a little background as to why 18? Because I agree with your principle and philosophy. This committee has seen non-compete, but it's been pretty limited to broadcast, where they have an image that's been developed and all that. And there I can see where you're actually heavily investing in somebody and building this, this profile of this person. So I'm assuming that other people want it to either have nothing or they want it 2 years, because it said split the baby. So I'm thinking 18 months between the two.
Yeah, Senator and Chair Przanski, that's right. I split the baby between 0 and 2, which 2 was, I believe, the current Oregon law, and went 12, saying couldn't we ease it back to there? And then I think the committee in the House split the baby between 12 and 24 and just said 18, in part because there were some legitimate opposition. AOI and a few others came in and said, hey, some of these companies really do invest, and I get that. And ultimately the choice that I looked at is, Oregon's in a certain situation where we got to make some policy calls. I think given the fact that our income between Oregon and Washington is now $7,000 difference. We got to start doing a little more out of the box thinking about saying, how do we get more spawning of the innovation in small business sector? So in that regard, I like 12.
Right.
If you want to amend it to 12, I'd be thrilled. At 18, I'll take that.
Well, it sounds like at 18 there won't be. I mean, there's no one else that signed up, so it sounds like everyone's standing down. If we go back to 12,
yeah,
it seems to me. Why don't we just? I mean, I would just suggest that we stay where we're at, see how it works. We can always make another adjustment, but this is definitely going to be something better than what it currently is. Senator
Thank you, Thatcher. Mr. Chair.
Would this affect current contracts?
I don't. Chair Przanski and Senator Thatcher.
No, it doesn't.
It's not retroactive, is that right?
It applies to non-compete agreements entered on or after next January 1. And I would say that we couldn't breach or, let's say, impact a existing contract. I mean, it's kind of like the PERS thing and everything else. I mean, once you got the contract set, you're not going to be able to undo it. And so we don't want to set up those legal causes. Other questions and comments for the representative? Thanks.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate it.
All right. So we're going to I'm going to ask, since this was called out early, was there anyone else who wanted to testify on House Bill 3236A? Seeing people standing up, just making sure I'm not running into any other discussion. We'll close the public hearing. And I believe this bill is ready to go as is. Senator Cruz?
You've got to go into work session.
Work session on House Bill 3236A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3236A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3236A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Ferrioli will be our carrier since he's actually on the bill, and he'll have to carry this since he's on the bill, right? Okay. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3236A. Now, let's see. I think what I want to do is, before we go over there, let me just make sure. Yep, that's the one I want to go to. And let me just get back to her name. So we're going to reopen the public hearing on 3452A and have Shelley Day please come forward. And while she's coming up, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 3452A? Good morning, Shelley.
Hi. Hi, Chair Brzezinski and the committee. For the record, I am Shelley Day, and I'm the Director of Community Relations for Camp Attitude, Oregon. I thank you for this opportunity to testify on 3452A. We are neutral with amendments to 3452A. I've submitted a letter to you guys expressing Camp Attitude's concerns regarding House Bill 3452A. So I'll do my best not to repeat the information in the letter. But please give me a little leeway. If I do, I apologize. We have been in touch with Representative Widener's office regarding an amendment to the bill that will address our concerns with the House bill. And so our understand, and he's agreed to, well, we've just talked to him regarding some of those amendments. I want to tell you a little bit about Camp Attitude. It's located just outside of Sweet Home. It's a camp that's for children with disabilities and their families. We invite all different types of disabilities to the camp, whether it's children with autism, Down syndrome. My son has cerebral palsy. I've been affiliated with them for 3 years. It's a place, it's very unique to any place in the United States. It's a camp much like maybe all of you have been to in your childhood, where you stay overnight, do camp activities. We go out on the lake. We try to make sure that the children with the disabilities can do anything that anybody could do. We provide respite for the parents or the foster parents or whoever is their caregiver so that they can have some downtime. We make sure that they have the best experience they possibly can. Our concern with 3452 is the fact that our budget is done just to get by. You know, we function on all volunteer basis. This camp is free to these families. Some families come with just their caregiver and the child with disabilities, all up to, we have a family coming this year with 14 family members because they support their 3 children with a disability. And that is all free, all their meals, their housing, every activity. So, and all these people coming are volunteers. We provide a buddy with each of the children that come. The child with a disability, sometimes 2 buddies. If there's an autistic child who requires high activity levels, we have to provide 2 buddies for them. So our insurance costs are a quarter to one-fifth of our budget at this point. So if this bill is passed as is, that will increase our exposure and we may not be able to afford to run the camp because our insurance costs will go up. And so with that being said, we are a lawyer for our camp who does function on a volunteer basis as well, because we can't afford him otherwise, is working on some changes, amendment changes, to work with Representative Widener so that we can include nonprofits. Because Chair Brzezinski and Senator Thatcher, the question that you asked Representative McLean, he answered it in a way as if the nonprofit was not the landowner. They were the sponsor. Does that make sense? And we are the landowner of our property. We own the 24 acres that all of our buildings, all of our you know, when all the children and the families and our volunteers are on our property, we are the liable persons. And then in the off season, what we do is so that we can support the camp, because we are a nonprofit and we do not get paid, we try to rent our property out to different, like this coming weekend, we have an adult group coming in that are all people of disabilities, because our whole 24 acres is set up to handle anybody with any type of disability. So we rent it out so that we can support the camp during the 8 weeks that we have people. So during each 8 weeks, we have 250 people at our camp, 240 actually, because of the fire marshal. But anyway, I digress there. So anyway, my point is that we are the landowner. We aren't the sponsor of them. So I think this bill is set up to, Representative McLean's point is for private landowners who can't afford to have that be the purpose. And the nonprofits such as Boy Scouts or ourselves or whatever, we can't afford in our small little world at Camp Attitude to be able to handle it. Let's say if we had four children on an ATV, which we do have ATVs because we try to provide the experience of any typically functioning child. If we had a child on an ATV and he ran into a building, we need to be able to get that building set back up the way it was in a handicap accessible situation. So, you know, we need to be able to afford to reset things up. So in that point, we would need to be able to have that cost deferred. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I do have a couple of questions based on what I've heard. So we'll look at whatever amendments come forward, but it seems from what I'm hearing, I don't think this would be your intent, but if you had indemnifications across the board, all of those families that come at no expense because they can't afford it, whatever assets they have, if they are signing that, they're going to be at risk for an injury that occurs to a different child who is there at the same camp, and even though the other families had no direct contact and that injury occurring from the indemnification, they could be on the hook for whatever you or the Camp Attitude could be held liable for as to the process. Then, Shelley, I heard you say that if you had damage to the building, you'd need to have some way of being able to recover that. And so, I mean, would it be the intent of the Camp Attitude to go after all of those families that are there?
Absolutely not.
Right.
That is not our intent at all.
So that,
no.
I'll look forward to seeing the amendments, because I'm not sure exactly what it's going to address. But, I mean, the waivers are one thing, and that's where everyone enters the property, uses the property, unless they can show some type of willful conduct on your part,
right,
or I mean the organization's comp would be basically not held accountable for risk that they took,
yeah,
as long as they're reasonable, not unreasonable, et cetera.
Right. We just want to limit our exposure so that we can afford the insurance so that we can cover, you know, keep our camp going into the future for the children, of course, so that we can keep it open. And we absolutely have no intention of doing that, exactly as you said.
Right. So does your insurance carrier require you to enter into indemnification clauses with whoever's coming to the camp?
They don't require it. But as you know, as soon as you make any changes to insurance, they're going to increase our liability coverage, the cost of our liability
Do you know whether or not your insurance policy or your contractual agreements with the families that are coming, do you require them to, one, enter into a contract, and two, does it have indemnification clauses in it?
I do not know the answer of the indemnification clause. I can get that answer for you. But we do require some level of, you know, the waiver issue. I do know that standard. Just to, you know, cover everything.
That's pretty standard.
Yeah.
So I would ask you to check to see whether or not your contracts or whatever agreements you have the families enter into, if it actually has an indemnification clause, because if it doesn't.
I'm being told yes, yes, and yes.
Yes, it does?
Yes.
All right. So thank you for the lifeline of being able to respond to us.
I'm being monitored.
That's quite all right. We all are.
Yeah, I know that. So the answer is yes, yes, and yes.
All right. So, I mean, those are the issues I think we have to be looking at. I think the part about whether your insurance would be changed and adjusted because of that,
yeah.
I think that's something else that needs to be followed up. But I guess I'm not really sure what good the indemnification clauses are in your contracts if you're not going to hold those families accountable. And so it seems to me that needs to be looked at with your insurance carriers and all that, and who tell Ross thank you.
Oh, he's not even talking to me about that. So the other thing that I need to, does anybody else have any questions for me?
Senator Thatcher, did you have a question?
Well, I guess I'm hoping that we wait until the amendment comes forward.
We are definitely going to wait.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I think we owe it to this process. You know, we do this on multiple issues. This is one that we just needed before we look to pass something and cross the T's, dot the I's as to making certain we know what we're doing so we're informed before we do it. I can tell you I'm somewhat concerned about having these waivers because, when I say waivers, exclusions of and allowing for the indemnification clauses because of what we've already heard. But clearly we're going to take all of this in account before we make any.
Yeah, because it affects us greatly because, like I said, it's definitely like a quarter. At this point now, it's a quarter of our budget that we're currently paying. And the work we do is just amazing. And because of that, I absolutely want to invite you guys up. I've given each of you a pamphlet. And I would love it if any of you would take some time out at any point where our camps start on Father's Day weekend and run halfway through August. If you're up that way or have any opportunity to come up there, I would love it if you contact me and I will meet you at the gate and love to have you come and visit the camp. You'll find it absolutely amazing up there.
Okay.
It's a beautiful place and I would love it if you want to come up, and if you're with your families, even the better. So please take a moment to come, or I'll meet you up there in the off season and show you around if you'd like that too. So anyway, with the amendments, it would be great if you'd take an opportunity to look at those, because we just want to work together to have the opportunity to manage some of this. So
I appreciate your concerns. We won't be moving the bill today. We'll wait and get the amendment. We'll look at it. We'll get the interested parties together and to see what, if anything, we can do or need to do to consider those considerations.
Wonderful.
Thank you very
much.
Okay,
thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You bet. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3452A. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and reopen on House Bill 3399A. And Jad and Carl, why don't y'all come on up. So we're going to need to continue to talk, and so we're going to set a time, and I'm going to let Shauna make a decision, I think, at 1 o'clock, and we're going to do this offline. But I'm going to put a few things out there because I've got to tell you guys, I'm pretty disturbed with what I heard and the positions y'all are taking. Knowing the position I've looked at and how we've set up for court of records to allow municipal courts or JP courts to actually become court of records, I find some of the stuff that was said today is to be inconsistent. I will just put on the record that I believe where we have life, liberty, and freedom, blah, 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 in the balance, and you are making decisions about people's liberties in the criminal area, that we need to ensure that individuals that are in that position have people that understand the law and know what they're doing as compared to not having some type of legal training. Regarding prior work on this bill, Representative Nancy Nathanson has worked on this bill for at least 4 years. Not this particular bill that we have before us, 3399, but the concepts, because I know I've sat down with her at least 2 times, if not 3 times. I also know from my discussions there has been input to some level from y'all to as to what has been contemplated over those that period of time. And Carl, I'm not sure if I can understand the rational basis of saying you'd like to have the Chief Justice, who controls all judges, to be controlling, but then you're bringing out the home rule as to, you know, if there's a home rule and the cities and the counties have their ability to basically work independently of the state, then, you know, I don't see how you can that statement just doesn't seem consistent with your statement. So,
Mr. Chair, Carl Myers for the record, it is appropriate to argue in the alternative. I was simply suggesting that if home rule doesn't apply, then certainly the best place for resolution of these issues as to the education ought to lie with the Chief Justice, who sets and the Supreme Court, that sets all other responsibilities for judges and lawyers throughout the state, rather than in a circuit court judge who may not have the time or the interest, quite frankly, in doing that. But that's, again, we are asking, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that there be an alternative educational program to...
We will discuss that this afternoon.
Okay.
We'll take care of some of those considerations. I already have some thoughts as to how we're going to do
and
it.
May I add, Representative Smith said that there are a number of states that require judges to go to that National Judicial Conference. Those trips by JPs and municipal judges are paid by the states in those cases, so they're not left to the local jurisdiction. Those are unified courts and all part of the state court system, a system we do not have in Oregon.
That's correct. And regarding having the circuit court be what I consider a ability to allow certain people to have exemptions and exceptions is unworkable for me. That sets up potentially what I would call a good old boy system, as saying, we'll let you go in and you can practice as a judge at this particular court on whatever they deem is appropriate with no standards. That just is not going to cut the mustard. The time frame for completing cases, Jad, I got to be really concerned if it's taking a JP court or a municipal court a year and a half to do a misdemeanor trial, something is wrong with the court. And I heard that it could take a year to a year and a half once it's going forward. And that, to me, is not efficient running of a court and getting justice if that's taking that length of time on a regular basis. Clearly, there could be some small fraction that could be impacted by that. Implementation date and effective date, we can get through that. That's not a big deal. And, guys, I'm just not real pleased right now as to the position that your organizations are taking in what I consider where you actually have people's liberty at risk and in the balance to the point of where you're basically saying this is not workable, and there's to basically say that there's been no input from your associations, maybe not with House Bill 3399A, but clearly with the concepts, because I've been engaged with Representative Nathanson long enough as to the feedback she continues to tell me she has gotten, or the lack of participation in some cases from your organizations. So with that, if you want to have that opportunity to work offline, we'll be doing that at 1 o'clock today in the Judiciary Office. And if not, then I will be working with the chair on the other side, as well as Representative Nathanson. We will make some modifications. I believe you made a few points that need to be addressed, and we can do it. But as far as the chair is concerned, this is a bill that is needs to be moved forward, and we'll take in the accommodations that you want us to and ensure that we actually get it done. Any other comments from the dais? Gentlemen, thank you. I hope to see you at 1 o'clock. All right, with that, closing the public hearing at this point, 3399A. And what do we have in the way of work sessions? Okay, we're going to do three quick work sessions. Which one are we starting with? Starting off the work session with House Bill 2333.
Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, House Bill 2333 came to us at the request of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary. This bill pretty much unanimously passed the House Judiciary and the House floor with a few excused votes. We had public hearing on this on May 21st. So we have before us today the proposed Dash 1 amendment, which replaces the term insane with updated, modernized language. House Bill 2383 aims to correct the unintended consequences caused by some drafting that occurred in 2007 and after, having to do with Oregon's minority tolling statute. The bill is ready to move. And we also do have a letter to remove a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means if the committee chooses to do so.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2333.
Senator Cruz moves Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2333. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2333 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a request that the subsequent referral of the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2333 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation, also requesting that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be lifted. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Thinking that this bill will go to the floor, Senator Gelser, will you be the carrier on this
I'd
one?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Thank you.
And Senator Gelser will be the carrier on House Bill 2333. And we'll close that work session. And we're going to open up our work session on on House Bill 2365A.
Chair Pozetsky, members of the committee, House Bill 2365A comes to us at the request of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary for Oregon Law Commission. This bill unanimously passed the House Judiciary and the House floor, and we previously had a public hearing on it on May 5th. We do have a proposed Dash A4 amendment, which reverts back to current law in Section 1, which addresses the Indian Child Welfare Act, and it also adjusts the operative dates to allow fee schedules to go into effect in the course of the regular cycle. So this bill is the result of a large 37-member work group that was headed by Oregon Law Commission to update the adoption laws in this state. And it should be noted that Oregon has served as a national model on this front.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A4 amendment into House Bill 2365.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 3 amendment into House Bill 2365A. Or is it 4? I apologize. I knew I said that wrong. 4. Moves the Dash 4s. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2365A as amended by the Dash A4 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2365A as amended by the A4s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, will you carry this one? So we're going to close that work session, open up a work session on House Bill 2366A.
As Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2366A is the counterpart to 2365A. We have no amendments before us on this bill today. It also unanimously passed the House Judiciary and House floor, and we have public hearing on this bill on May 5th. It is ready to move today.
Chair, I move House Bill 2366A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2366A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Again, Senator Cruz, if you'll be our carrier on those tag team. All right, so that takes care, I believe, of what we have. So we're going to go through and make sure I've crossed the T's and dot the I's. First of all, regarding House Bill 3399A, we will be carrying that bill over for the work session this next Monday, which is our next day to meet. That will be June 1st. 6-1.
This might be a bit late.
That would be a bit late. So that's Monday, June 1st. The next bill that we have already carried over, but we're putting on the record again, is House Bill 3452A. It also will be carried over to Monday, which is June 1st. Dropping down to our work session bills, we're carried over, but we're putting on the record again, House Bill 2357A to June 1st, again, our next day to meet. And the last one I have that we've already carried over, but stating on the record again, is 3093A, also to Monday, June 1st. Jennifer, have we got everything? And
which one did
China saying yes? Okay. With that, thank you all very much for staying over 5. We will be back on Monday. So what do we have for start time? Is that
8 a.m.
She is.
And do we need to be here 8 a.m.?
Could probably do 8:15, but I'm not sure if we would be well served to go to 8:30.
Let's give us the flexibility.
It's a pretty it's a pretty hefty schedule with some carryovers in it.
And she is doing her mock Congress today.
Oh, how many bills we have up here?
Just all day long, everybody.
One, two, four,
and then we're carrying our work sessions.
The work session, I'm not worried about.
Want to do 8:30 and be real diligent? We can do it.
All right, colleagues, we have to make a decision on Monday. I know that many would not like to be here right at 8 o'clock. I'm more than willing to do that. But if we put it to 8:30, we need to really get started at 8:30 so we can make sure we have enough time. We'll probably get finished. As we all look at
I knew how that vote was going to go. She's
scheduled for 8:15, and
deal. She's powerful. She is pro tem. I mean, there you go.
Okay.
So we're going to carry. We're going to start at 8:30 on Monday, June 1st, and we'll probably be so much the task will be done in an hour. But guess what? Then you have an extra 30 minutes. Well, I'm going to go to the other end. With that, safe journeys for all for the weekend. And we're adjourned.
What day is this?
And we're adjourned.
What day is this?
For the weekend.